Next week, we... what did I assign to you? What's it called?
Something about nuns? Nuns with guns?
Yes. our next... fuck. Okay. Cut all that out.
Welcome to another episode of the MacGuffin Podcast, the movie review podcast that dreams are made of. Keith Foster, you are still in San Diego.
Yes, I am, and you are not. You are in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Yes, where you will be in a few days, actually.
Yeah, we're going to come and visit for the Memorial Day weekend, get an extra day off.
Festivities.
Gonna do some fun things.
If we have a podcast next week, we'll talk all about that, I'm sure. But today we're going to be reviewing The Sun Is Also a Star. And at the end of the podcast for our Netflix homework, we're also going to be reviewing, have to look this up, this long title.
Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile.
Yes, the Ted Bundy biopic starring Zac Efron. There's one thing I wanted to ask you last episode that we never got to at the top of the show. Oh, and I think what?
We didn't go over this in the show notes. This is gotcha podcasting right here.
Yes, it is. Did you watch the trailer for Laquisha?
No, I didn't. You sent that to me. And I was going to watch it, but then I didn't.
Oh, good. Then we could just record this live. Keith, okay. Go ahead and watch the trailer for Laquisha. I'll edit in the trailer noise, but I want your reaction. We're going to get a live trailer reaction here on the top of the show.
Okay, hold on. I have to find it. Oh, God. How long ago was it? Oh, there it is. Okay, so how do you want... Oh, no. Video unavailable. This video has been removed by the user.
Oh, my God. Hold on. Hold the phone.
I'm going to see if I can find it. Okay. Hold on. Breaking. Laquisha movie trailer stirs controversy for having racist storyline. I found it.
You found the trailer?
I think I found it.
Okay. Let me know when you've started it.
All right. I'm hitting play now.
You always seem to say the right thing to just the right person. What's your secret?
I'm really just talking to myself. I don't charge for my advice.
Well, you should, because it was amazing. I saw this, and I thought of you. You will be a hit in no time.
Welcome to the Joe Show. I submitted myself to a radio station for my own show.
Well, congratulations.
They rejected me.
Well, congratulations, then.
You weren't right for your own show?
Jason skipped it. You need to get the money for this school.
$13,000 a semester? Asking me is their own show. If I was a black woman, I'd be perfect.
Oh, no.
She's brilliant.
I know. Get her in here.
Look, we're gonna be
the biggest thing in radio, but I still need my anonymity.
You nervous?
Oh, my God.
It's theater.
You live with Laquisha. What's your problem?
Hi, Laquisha. It's Bree.
Oh, I ain't talking to you, not the way you sound. Next caller.
You go, girl.
You just be good to her. If you good to yourself, you can be good to others.
Don't be too good because the police are coming.
No.
Where did you get this?
I got another job.
Doing what?
Consulting work. What the hell would you know about being a white guy anyway?
I know quite a bit.
Loquisha is a real role model for every African American woman on this planet.
Fucking
like
God,
the whole city has Loquisha mania.
I am Loquisha, officer.
What was that?
I think I might be a black woman trapped in a white man's body.
You need to talk to Loquisha.
What
just
the
because she's
fuck
a woman
is
and a
this?
Black person doesn't mean that she doesn't understand you.
Is this really happening?
I'm on a bridge above the river and I'm gonna jump.
But thanks for calling. Enjoy your jump.
I gotta
what
start listening to her.
Fuck. Okay. God damn it. So that, I mean, okay, so gut reaction is obviously this isn't a real movie. I mean, it might be feature length, but
right.
It's obviously some fucking thing that this guy thought was hilarious and was like too un-PC to be restrained, right? He's one of those real talking white, old, grumpy ass white comics. I guess. I don't know.
So, okay. I mean, you probably got it all there in the trailer, but the general premise of the story is a white radio host can't get a job as a boring white guy, so he starts doing this ridiculous blackcent over the radio, which is not even
we'll
like...
No, we'll talk about that in a second. Just keep breaking down the trailer for people.
Okay. So, and then because of that, this character he invents called Loquisha becomes like world famous, and it puts him in a bind because he has to withhold the secret that he's actually a white guy, and hilarity apparently ensues. So when this trailer came on, it's very interesting that they pulled the trailer now, but I didn't know
I saw, so the link you sent me pulled it, but
yeah, which was the official page, I think.
Well, I think the star, the main guy.
Who wrote and directed it as well, yes.
Yeah, I could tell. I could tell. And paid for every cent of it.
Probably.
I could tell from the Flash animation title with stock Photoshop font. we're dealing with a real visionary here. Yeah, no. So he posted it on his page, so...
Mm-hmm.
Whatever. Yeah, I mean, here's know, if I was a black woman, then I'd be able to say whatever the hell I want, which isn't true. You still have to be talented and funny.
Can we talk about how not even convincing his accent is, his character?
Well, that's
cuz like
that's
just
where
reading
I was kidding.
Reading because the premise online before I like clicked on the trailer and watched it, I was expecting him to do a much bigger, like bolder impression.
Yeah,
and it's like
it just sounds
so
like a
lazy.
White guy doing like it's real lazy and real racist. It just sounds like somebody talking like this, and that's supposed to be a black woman, but it definitely sounds like a middle-aged white man who's angry and condescending as fuck.
Right.
So, like, the entire premise hinges on his ability to do this character that's hilarious, but it's not. Like it's, I mean, the people who do those kinds of things at least can do the character to sell it. Whether or not it's insensitive, you know, whatever, it's just a bad character. It's not funny. It's not a good. It's
not
a good
bit. But do you want to bet that there's that, you know, in this movie that was made in 2019, do you want to bet that It doesn't surprise that there is some overarching message in the third act about how we're really all the same, and you know, we should be like judging on the merits of our whatever. I don't even know. Some sort of racial but unity story.
The funny thing to me is you say, because I remember you sending me this message. You said, can you believe this got made in 2019? And my response to that is, of course it got made in 2019.
Well, let's be clear. This would not open wide.
This won't even be in theaters.
This would probably hit like maybe the festival circuit and then go straight to DVD.
I don't even think that. I think you're giving it way more credit than it deserves. I think this is going to be like a YouTube thing. This looks like the kind of money that I've been dealing with in productions I do.
Okay, cool. So let's go ahead, and we have a couple news stories, and we can knock these out really fast because we do have a listener survey that I want to get to. But there's only a couple things that popped up here, and one of these is a MacGuffin exclusive. Keith, why don't you tell us what's going on with this goon story?
Okay, so there is a comic book from creator Eric Powell called The Goon, and it's about this character named The Goon. Who lives in sort of this fairy tale, dystopic, like 1930s depression era town that's overrun with zombies and black magic and bad feelings. And he's sort of this heavy gangster type character who defends the people of Lonely Street. Like 4 or 5 years ago. He teamed up with David Fincher as a producer to come up with this little test reel of animation for what a Goon 3D animated feature could look like. They used this to launch a Kickstarter to help fund a storyboard for an entire movie. Obviously, they couldn't fund an entire CGI movie through Kickstarter. They were just hoping to create a good enough sizzle reel and storyboard that they could pitch it to real studios so that it could get, you know, sort of the real production that it needs. The Kickstarter happened. I put a lot of money into it. I got a signed poster. Actually, David Fincher signed it. And all the people involved, Eric Powell, Clancy Brown, Paul Giamatti, they all signed it. I'm actually staring at it right now. It's in my office. And it seemed like, you know, they got it funded. Everything was good for a while. And then I just kind of didn't hear about it for like 3 years.
Sure. And
so it just kind of faded into obscurity.
But
until last week, I got an email from the Kickstarter campaign that says, "The Goon Kickstarter is back from the dead. As loyal fans, we wanted you folks to be the first to know the Goon feature is officially in development at 20th Century Fox. And we owe a huge debt of thanks to you and our backers for keeping the faith during this long journey. You helped us keep the dream alive. Without you, we couldn't have gotten this far. With your generous contributions, we were able to finish a full storyboard animatic of the film, complete with excellent voice acting, sound design, and music. The template for the film sold the producers and the studio on the potential of a Goon movie, and we're beginning a new round of development." So, what exactly does development mean? Well, it doesn't mean we're making the movie next week. The proverbial Hollywood green light always happens in phases, but it does mean we've got fresh wind in our sails, the resources of a studio, and some quotation marks, heavy hitter, in quotation mark, producers behind us. Which producers, you may ask? The Chernin Group. They've brought us movies such as the Planet of the Apes franchise, Red Sparrow, and Oblivion. They love the project, and we're all excited about this next phase, along with Eric, David Fincher, and all the folks at Blur. Blur is the animation studio. Nice. So that's pretty exciting news. One thing that makes me a little nervous is that I don't know if we talked about this or if too much time passed. Fox did just cancel the Mouse Guard CGI animated film.
I didn't know about that.
So that's another small comic that got picked up by Fox, and that also had a lot of voice talent behind it. But once the Disney merger happened, they said that the animation and the character design was too similar to projects such as like the Jungle Book and Lion King, and so they didn't want it to be associated with the Disney brand.
Oh, I thought Disney just didn't want to have any other competing mice.
I mean, that's kind of what it is. But this email has come out firmly after the merger has happened, so I don't mm-hmm. think they would have said anything if it was on the fringe like that. And I think Mouse Guard has already gotten picked up by another studio, so I think cool. both movies will end up happening. And I talked about this a little bit during our review for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and how I think the success of that movie is going to kind of open the doors for less traditional animated features.
We can hope so. And I hope that they, you know, with the merger with Disney, that they stick true to their not just for kids animation vision, because, you know, Disney, if they can squeeze a buck out of it by maybe lowering it from a PG-13 to a PG or a G, they will.
I really don't think, just knowing the type of creator that Eric Powell is, I think he would burn it to the ground before he let them change it too much.
Disneyfy it.
Yeah. I think.
Yeah. With churning behind it and everything, I think that bodes well as well. So, that's pretty exciting. That's pretty exciting news.
Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'll be seeing a Goon movie here in a few years.
Okay, so this is the big story. This is like the big news that came out over the last weekend. Mm-hmm. And I guess the people who are trying to start a new Batman movie, The Batman, with Matt Reeves behind the helm, they have been paring it down to who is going to play the Caped Crusader. And they have a kind of a short list going. And at the top of that list, is Robert Pattinson. There's also been some whispers about Nicholas Hoult, Armie Hammer, Aaron Taylor Johnson, but it looks like Robert Pattinson is very, very close to being selected. And the internet is interneting over it right now.
Yeah. So the internet is shitting their pants about this.
Right.
Which I don't...
Petitions are online.
Can we start a petition to stop bullshit, dumbass petitions that don't
fan
understand
petitions.
How studios work?
Yeah. Like, and how expensive things are.
Yeah, like they petitioned for this fucking Batman thing. They petitioned to redo the last season of Game of Thrones, which wasn't the best. But just, I'm so sick of the fan entitlement. Like, just because something isn't the way you want it to be doesn't make it automatically bad. And if it's something you care that much about, try doing your own fucking thing. Like, yes, obviously you can't make a huge budget Batman, you know, studio picture, but fan films are a fucking thing. And they have a pretty big internet following. Like, do your own fucking Batman thing. I don't give a fuck about the fan petitions. They can go fuck themselves with their petitions.
I agree. But how do we feel about, personally, how do we feel about our Pats in the cape and cowl?
So that's another thing that annoys me about this reaction, is people are reacting to his performance in a fucking teenage girl movie from like
10 years ago.
He wouldn't have been my first choice personally. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bummed out, because this means I'll never get my John Hamm as Batman movie. Because let's be real, we only have a couple years of John Hamm as a viable Batman left.
Right. Unless you're doing like an older Batman kind of situation.
Yeah, which that could work. But I think, like, you know, you start filming with John Hamm tomorrow, that would be, like, the defining Batman for a generation, but what do I know? So
other and it seems that, by it seems if you're looking at their selection of their shortlist, seems like the goal is to go younger.
Yeah, and I'm sure they're trying to they're thinking franchise, like long term. Right. You know, who can we get, you know, 4 to 5 movies out of, which is smart. Like, I get that. Yeah. So as far as that goes, I don't I've never really seen Robert Pattinson in anything. I don't think, like, I've seen him as Cedric Diggory, but
right.
So
getting ganked by Voldemort.
Yeah. But I don't care. Like, I'm not offended by it. I am like, okay, cool. Like, if I'm going to put enough trust in Matt Reeves' directorial vision, which everything I've heard about this project so far, I'm on board with.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, let's whatever. Like, I'll never get so upset about a casting notice like this ever since my reaction to hearing Heath Ledger would play the Joker. I remember thinking that sounded like garbage. What? The dude from 10 Things I Hate About You? That's going to be terrible. I was that shitty fan. All of the promotional material I saw with him, I was just like, oh, it's too dark and weird. And then I saw the movie and I shut the fuck up because it was amazing.
Right. Yeah, so I put my faith in the hands of Matt Reeves. I'm really excited about what he's going to do with the Batman because he's a real director. And he knows how to tell a story, and he knows how to pace a story, and I think that he, you know, I mean, we can go back as far as 1988 or whatever to when people were pissed off that Mr. Mom was going to be Batman.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's been so many, and, you know, we've had mixed results on our Batman casting, but I think that, you know, I've seen a little bit of non-Twilight Robert Pattinson, and I think he's an interesting-ish actor. He's very interior, which you need for the character. I think he's kind of one of those guys who's as good as his director.
Mm-hmm.
And given that I trust Matt Reeves, I think we can expect decent stuff out of him. I'm really kind of nonplussed with this choice. It would, again, wouldn't have been my first choice, wouldn't have been my 10th choice, but we'll see what they get out of him.
Yeah, like
he's been doing a lot of, like, high-end kind of, like, prestige stuff lately. I mean, there was that movie Good Time, people say it's good. Mm-hmm. He just did a movie with Claire Denis recently, so, you know, he's had a few movies with David Cronenberg. So he's not just the Twilight guy anymore.
No, I think people need to shut the fuck up. Like, I just don't even understand getting offended by that choice. I was just like, when I heard, I was like, oh, okay, sure, I guess. Like,
unfortunately, most of those movies I just mentioned were not seen by most people, so they really only know him as the twinkling vampire.
Yeah, but that wasn't his fault. It wasn't like fucking...
No, I know.
It wasn't like Robert Pattinson came on set and was like, what if I sparkle?
No, of course
those
not.
Those are bad movies, but they're not his fault.
No, they're not. But, you know, unfortunately, most people who go to the movies, they end up, you know, putting the success or the blame of a movie onto the actors because that's what they identify with the most. Well, so that it is what it is. But I think once the trailers come out and it looks like it's going to be a solid picture, if it is, then I think people start shutting up.
Yeah, I hope so. We should just do a new segment called Shut the Fuck Up, the Internet.
we want them to speak up right now because we did do a listener survey.
Yes.
We did do a listener survey where we actually called upon the voices of the people who graciously listened to our show. And
yeah.
I saw this on Twitter. And I'll read the Twitter responses first, actually. Okay. The question that I posed was name an underrated movie. And, you know, that can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So I was excited to see what kind of responses we got Patrick, friend of the show, Patrick, who's been on the show, he says Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. I would concur. Although nowadays, that's kind of getting cooler and cooler to like. It used to be like the redheaded stepchild of the Halloween series, and you know, people didn't speak of its name. But now it's been sort of fully reevaluated, I think, at least within the horror community.
I've never seen that one. I should give it a chance. Was that one done by John Carpenter?
No, he was an executive producer. He only did the first one.
Okay.
But he was still a producer in it, and it has very Carpenter-esque qualities to it, like the synth soundtrack and that kind of stuff. But it's worth looking at. It's a very weird movie. Kind of feels like a long Goosebumps episode. Kelly Honeycutt, friend of the show. He's been listening for a while, actually. Saved. Do you remember that movie?
Oh, yeah. That is a fun movie.
Susan Sarandon's daughter and Macaulay Culkin, one of his like later roles, about a Christian college. Jenna Malone, I think, is the main character in that. Sort of a satire. Yeah, that's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
All right. Now, let's head over to Facebook. And do you want to read a couple of these?
Ben Martinez says, The 13th Warrior. Good choice. Mm-hmm.
Solid choice.
Totally agree with that one. That was also kind of a box office flop when it came out.
Yeah, that was like one of those. Was that a Michael Crichton adaptation?
It was based on a Michael Crichton book where he was loosely retelling the story of Beowulf.
Right.
Which I guess he...
With Antonio Banderas, because he was really famous at the time.
Yeah, yeah. That's a pretty, like, 90s action movie, kind of, like, late 90s. Right.
I totally understand. I know Ben, and I totally understand why this is one of his picks, is because he's a history geek, specifically war history. So any movie with, like, people running around in, like, shields and swords, he's all about. That was one of the better shields and swords movies.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of that as a genre.
Right. Especially if it's like snowing and in slow motion. And
yeah, which thanks to Game of Thrones, like the...
You got nine seasons of that. Say what you will
about the finale. Like, we got a lot of good shield and sword action over the years.
For sure. For sure.
Okay, Robert Barnett says, Pool Hall Junkies.
Never seen it.
I think I have, but I don't remember it. I think I watched it with McElprang a long time ago.
Mm-hmm. Who also answered one of these.
Yeah, he said, speaking of, Chris McElprang says, The Love Guru, which I always...
Controversial choice.
So, yes, it is. Especially since we were talking about, you know, blackface and in this case, kind of brownface. I mean, he doesn't put on brownface, but it is definitely a cultural appropriation.
Right.
I recently, a friend of the show, Mike Brown, he guested when we did the It review.
Yeah.
He's been doing this thing. I'll give him a little bit of a plug. He's been doing this thing where he just talks about movies on Facebook Live.
Okay.
You can check him out at Gotta Love Them Movies. And I recently asked him what his least favorite good movie was and his favorite bad movie. And his answer for favorite bad movie was The Love Guru.
Okay. So maybe it's having its Halloween 3 moment right now, or it's getting reevaluated. But there was a point in time where if you looked online for lists of like the worst movies, it was always on there, like next to Super Babies.
Totally. But after this, I kind of want to give it maybe a look.
Yeah. I mean, this is like a late period Mike Myers thing. Him kind of trying to like recreate the Austin Powers phase or craze. And actually, the other night, we just for fun started watching Austin Powers, The Spy Who Shagged Me. On cable. Uh-huh. And it was worse than I remember. And I wasn't a fan at the time.
Oh, really? I liked the first one, but I believe it.
No. Spy Who Shagged Me was the second one, right? Oh, no,
you said
the
Spy Who Shagged... Yeah, yeah, I'm sorry.
First one is International Man of Mystery, which I still have fond memories of, but I haven't seen it in forever.
It probably doesn't hold up, but...
Probably not.
Hudson Reynolds says The Other Guys.
I think that's a great answer.
That's one of the Will Ferrell movies I've missed, actually, which...
That's one of my favorites, actually. I agree with him. I think that it's like the whole sort of Will Ferrell, Adam McKay, run there in the mid 2000s. Mm-hmm. That's one of my favorites of the bunch.
All right, all right. That's
and it has parts in it that I still think about every once in a while, just a lot.
Okay. Kenneth Patrick says Titus. I'm assuming that's the Titus Andronicus. I'm assuming that's the one with
Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Or the television series from 2000 to 2002, starring comedian Christopher Titus. Mm-hmm. No, probably not that.
This is another one I haven't seen, but
me either.
You know, Anthony Hopkins doing Shakespeare. I bet it's decent.
I bet it's pretty good. Yeah. And then
the last one we have here is Katie Halverson says Angus.
Yes. Do you remember that movie?
Vaguely. Like, I just remember that I saw it, but I don't remember a thing about it.
1995 coming of age movie. About an overweight kid.
Yeah, I remember I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. Same here. I know it happened. I might have seen it. I'm not even 100% sure about that. But I definitely remember it.
I'm sure I saw it. I'm 100% certain. I saw it like when it came out. I rented it on VHS. But I remember liking it. It's like it was like a really charming... fun 90s coming of age comedy kind of thing.
Yeah, of which there were many.
Yeah.
Okay, Keith, what would be your answer for this question? What's an underrated film? Whatever that means to you.
Yeah, yeah. So the movie I'm picking definitely found its cult audience,
mm-hmm.
but it was considered a huge box office flop at the time. But I think it holds up. I'm talking about Starship Troopers.
Oh, yeah. I don't think I would call that underrated, but go ahead. Keep talking.
I don't know. Like I said, I think it's found its cult audience.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's a much smarter movie than it gets credit for. And true. I also didn't think about this question for a really long time.
Yeah, so if you go to a repertory theater and they're showing this movie now, it's not going to be, you know, it'll be packed. There'll be a lot of people there. There is a big cult audience for this movie. Although, you know what, maybe I'll still give it to you because I think that if you were not of that generation when that movie came out and you happened to be one of the few people to see it and understand it at the time, I don't know if there's like anyone under 25 who talks about that movie.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I actually have two more that I just thought of that kind of go together. If you don't want to accept Starship Troopers,
sure.
I'm ranking them both together because they're both Steve Martin vehicles. Sergeant Bilko, movie adaptation of the old ass. Like 60s TV show starring right. Steve Martin about a motor hall sergeant who like runs a gambling operation out of his motor hall and just gets up to shenanigans. Great movie. Really funny. Phil Hartman's in it. The late great.
Mm-hmm.
And the other movie also starring Steve Martin is Bowfinger.
Yeah.
But I just see Martin went through this period in the 90s, like the later 90s, sort of post-Father of the Bride, where his movies didn't seem to be connecting the way they used to be.
No.
But I actually think that's where some of his best work is, personally.
All right. Yeah. No. I've seen Sergeant Bilko, I think, on TV, like, you know, in pieces or whatever. So I don't have much of an opinion of that. But Bowfinger, I think we saw that together, actually, at the Real Theater, a dollar theater, and nearly died laughing.
Yeah. Which, to be fair, I have not seen it in a long time. So now I'm curious if it holds up.
Of course, I didn't know this at the time, but that was directed by Frank Oz, who later did Death at a Funeral and stuff like that. So I think it probably is funny.
Oh, and RDJ's in it, Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, like that was like height of, like, you know, his other period, we'll say. Christine Bransky. I mean, just everyone is great in that movie.
And Eddie Murphy is fucking, he does a dual role in it. And it's like the last movie I think I saw with him that actually made me laugh.
Yeah, probably. Okay, my answer for this question is, if we're going, this is almost like your Starship Troopers answer. If we're going like most underrated Coen Brothers movie, I'd say Barton Fink. I don't know, that might not count. I think that movie has its... It's pretty well lauded at this point, but I think it's like easily in my top three Coen Brother movies of all time, even to this day. And you just don't hear people talk about it as much for whatever reason.
Yeah. That's another one I haven't seen in a really long time, but I remember loving it.
Yeah. Like, it's one of their more darker, surreal kind of things. It was a period piece, takes place in like old Hollywood. Mm-hmm. But it's one of my favorites. Richard Linklater's Suburbia, which to this day has never had a DVD or Blu-ray release. It has never found a release past VHS, which is insane.
That is pretty nuts.
Especially with all the 90s nostalgia that's going on right now. And then, you know, he just was up for an Oscar for Boyhood. You think he would have tried to like capitalize on that. Criterion, get on this. I have a theory though. I think the movie is being held because there was talks for a long time that it was going to have a DVD release and it didn't happen. And I think the reason that it's having trouble is because the movie has a lot of source music, has one of those like hip 90s alternative rock soundtracks. And whenever you have that, the Daria box set had this problem for a long time, and eventually they just had to release it with new music on it. I think whenever you have that, it's really, really difficult to get the rights to all the songs, especially if like record labels don't exist anymore, or you don't know who has the masters, blah, 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 blah. And I think that's what's keeping Suburbia from, resurfacing again. But in case people want to like pirate it or whatever, or find a VHS tape on eBay or something. This was like based on an off-Broadway play about a bunch of kids who hang out, like very Gen X-y, hang out outside of a Circle K or something like that. And they're just sort of moping and talking about their life and talking about their future and not wanting to advance past, you know, whatever station in life they're at, sort of between high school and college and moving on and blah, blah, blah. And it's definitely one of those movies from that time, but I think it's one of the better movies of that time. And actually, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I there was a point in time when I preferred it to Dazed and Confused, which it was sort of the spiritual sequel to.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of that type of movie in the 90s. It was like disenchanted youth adults. Was like a whole fucking...
That was genre. A genre at the time. Yeah, 100%.
I remember I liked it. I think something about the simplicity of it, and maybe it's because it, you know, it's adapted from a play.
Yeah.
I don't know. There was always something I found charming about that movie.
Right, and unlike a lot of the movies like that, like Clerks or Mallrats or, you know, Empire Records or whatever, this one skewed a little bit more dramatic than the other ones.
Yeah, I will say sometimes, and I think this probably goes for a lot of these this genre of movie, it could tend to be a little self-important.
A little melodramatic, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I remember I had a good time with it. And it's like the only movie that I think Giovanni Ribisi's watchable in.
Oh, you're not a Ribisi fan? I don't mind him, but
what was the last thing you saw him in that was worth watching?
Well, I mean,
Sneaky Pete.
I haven't watched that. I don't know. Gone in 60 Seconds, the remake. He's been in stuff. He had an era, you know, specifically the 90s, and that was kind of when he was hot. But you know, even that's a crazy cast. I mean, you have like Nikki Catt, and you have Piper. What's her name? Pepper Potts.
She still looks very
Parker Posey. That's Parker Posey, yeah, and Steve Zahn, and yeah.
All right, let's talk about some movies.
Let's do that. Let's go ahead and talk about the movie that came out this week, that we saw in the theaters today. The Sun Is Also a Star. What happens in that movie?
Two young people fall in love. There is this young woman, character's name Natasha Kingsley. It is her last day as an American citizen. Her family's getting deported the next day.
To Jamaica.
So she's trying to make one last ditch effort at the immigration office, and she finds hope with this lawyer contact that she gets referred to that might take up her case. But basically, she's just trying to stay an American citizen. When she comes across a young Korean-American man named Daniel Bae, who is also similarly on the verge of a life-changing moment. He has an appointment to get a college referral because his family's pressuring him to go to medical school. They come across each other, fall in love, largely because Daniel doesn't know it is Natasha's last day as an American citizen. But she sort of finds herself getting swept up in the moment. And they fall in love. Romance. It's a romance movie,
more or less. And you know, the very New York, very New York centric.
This is New York porn.
Yeah,
I don't think this movie goes more than 15 minutes without these long sprawling shots of the city. I will say, the fucking New York Tourism Authority should use this movie, because I was like, oh, I want to go back to New York after watching it. But New York doesn't feel, it's not like a Woody Allen movie or Ghostbusters or something where the Spider-Man movies where New York is the third character or whatever. Like, I don't know, you don't really get a sense of the city a whole lot. You get a lot of shots of the city.
It doesn't come up in dialogue as much, but I'd say that the movie is really trying to be a New York film. The city's a character. I think it kind of is.
But the city doesn't seem to have as much life as other portrayals of it. I'll say that.
I think, it's a much more scaled down look at the city. But I mean, we see the subways, we see the skyscrapers.
Oh, don't get me wrong. This is a New York movie.
I likened it when I saw the trailer originally, and I'm very surprised that this got as wide of a release as it got for as, you know, kind of small and intimate of a movie as it is. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, okay, this is like the Millennials Before Sunrise, speaking of Richard Linklater, where Julie Delphi and Ethan Hawke walked around and I think Paris and fall in love over 24 hours.
Okay.
And just have these like long conversation set pieces. And
well, since you bring that up, story-wise, there's not a lot here.
No, it's I think purposefully kind of sparse. So because to focus more on character and focus more on these other kind of issues, and this is what I was going to say, is I think, you know, going in thinking this is largely just going to be a love story, which, you know, mostly it is, I think this is a lot more of the moment than I realized it was going to be. It's very, you know, with all the topics of
immigration
and deportation and that kind of stuff. They never say Trump in the movie, but he's, you know, sort of hovering over the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. They talk about policy changes and
how it's difficult to kind of keep up with it now, and how loopholes that used to exist don't anymore, and things like that. And so you have that, and then you have these two actors. You know, one character, Jamaican American, another the Korean American. So it's very intersectional in that way. And actually what I thought was interesting about this movie, as far as watching it, is I was a lot more kind of taken by their personal stories that are on the periphery of the overarching love story. Like, I was more kind of interested in like what was going on with the main character or the guy's family and his weird relationship with his brother, who's kind of ashamed to be Korean and doesn't even like to speak in Korean in public, and like this black hair salon that they run, and then like her and like you know, the stuff that her family's dealing with, and how long she's been living in America versus her family and all of this stuff. I actually found kind of that stuff to be more meaty. And more
totally. Well,
I was always kind of waiting for them to kind of catch up with those points while, you know, they're kind of like, you know, going to karaoke or they're walking through parks and that kind of stuff.
I feel like this movie feels like a student film that got picked up by a wider distribution center.
And
I don't mean that to be totally insulting, but I feel like there's stuff in this movie that does work, and it's all of the immigrant stories, like you're saying. All of that to me was really interesting. When the movie wasn't trying to push the drama, I was actually kind of interested and engaged. But all of the dramatic stuff felt so melodramatic to me, and sort of tonally off from the rest of the movie.
By dramatic, do you mean specifically the relationship stuff?
Not necessarily. I mean, like, the plot stuff. Because, like, the relationship stuff, a lot of that has to do with these two young actors' chemistry, which I think they have plenty of. I just think they don't have anything interesting to say to each other. I think there are a lot of script issues where they're just sort of walking around making faces at each other, but they're not really talking about anything. And I think, and they're sort of withholding these family stories a little bit. And when they actually talk about them, that's more interesting and it feels like there's more connection. But when they're talking about fate and destiny and
the stars and
Machina, I'm just rolling my eyes because it's so trite and mm-hmm. And like I said, melodramatic and poorly scripted out. And like a lot of the conflict between the main guy and his brother felt really forced. The acting ranges from pretty good to pretty bad in this.
I would agree. And sometimes from the same actor.
Yeah.
Like it kind of depends on what scene.
And I think a lot of that has to do with script issues.
I kind of feel like this might have been a fast shoot. This feels kind of a little, I mean, it feels like an indie. And it feels like the type of thing that, you know, they, you know, got a bunch of helicopter shots of the city, mm-hmm. and then they just kind of follow these characters around with a camera for you know, maybe 12 days or something like that. And it feels like because of that, they don't really soak into their characters as well as they should.
Yeah.
And in a way, it kind of feels a little stagey. It feels, even though it has such a big palette of New York City, and it's all, you know, shot in exteriors and on location, it feels a little like community theater sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Like the fucking subway scene?
Yeah.
where I audibly laughed out loud in the theater because it's so cheesy and on the nose and just like...
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah.
So I think the big difference, I mean, other than the racial aspect of it, which I agree is the most interesting part, between this and Linklater's Before trilogy is the dialogue. And I think that the quality of writing that you get from Linklater in those films and these long set pieces where they're discussing, you know, love and philosophy and poetry, and they're, you know, it can be just as pretentious, but the rhythm of the dialogue is a lot more impressive than what we get here.
I think that could have helped it is if so there, like you said, there are sometimes when they feel pretty genuine. And then there are other times when it feels so artificial. And honestly, like, even the immigration stories, I think that there's not anything in this movie that you couldn't get out of A, another movie.
Right.
But B, watch, if you think this is interesting or whatever, I would say watch Aziz Ansari's Netflix show, Master of None, because they deal with a lot of the same issues, but in much more interesting ways with characters that you're going to care a lot more about.
Yeah. I don't want to like bag on this movie entirely because I think that, you know, I think if you're of a certain age, like say you're 12 years old or something like that, like a 12 to 15 year old girl might really connect to this movie on a visceral level. And I think that it is, you know, of our time. And I think it's interesting because of that. I don't think it's necessarily good. I think it's more interesting than good sometimes, but I think it has some value in just of the being of its time at the time that it was made. And the fact that we so rarely get these kind of movies that get this sort of release. And I kind of want to encourage that. I think yes, we could do better than this. But I think that, you know, it's not so bad that I want to say never make another one of these again.
No.
I think it's well-meaning, but I think its heart's in the right place.
I agree with all of that, too. But, that doesn't make it good. Like, I think there are good moments. For sure. Uh-huh. I think there's some good stuff in here, but overall, I think this movie's not great. I think it errs on the side. It leans cheesier. Leans more cheesy than it does interesting. It's not like trash. I'm not going to say that, but we could do better. You know, I do want to see more movies like this get made, but I would like to see them of more quality. I would like to see them dig a little deeper. I don't know.
And this is based on like a novel by a Nicola Yuen. I don't know anything about the novel. It could be kind of a YA thing. It's kind of the vibe I'm getting. Yeah,
I think. A movie that that I think worked on these levels that where this one doesn't is kind of similarly. It came out a few years ago. The Fault in Our Stars, which is also based on a
YA.
Yeah, YA novel. And a lot of that movie lives and dies on Shailene Woodley and Ansel Elgort's chemistry together, but their characters just feel a little more real. And I think this movie needed that as well.
Yeah.
It feels like a sort of a diet version of that type of movie.
Right. Yeah. And it's kind of shot like a Coca-Cola commercial.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Like a really pretty one.
For sure. I mean, there's some gorgeous shots, but honestly, after like the 17th sweeping helicopter shot of New York, I was like, okay.
Yeah.
That's what I mean when I say it feels like a student film. If that's the case, then more power to you, but it just...
The director's done a couple things prior to this, but I know what you're saying. I don't want to promise too much from it, but I also don't want to describe it as being a wholly bad movie either, because I think it is kind of somewhere in the middle. For me, this is like a C+ joint. It's okay. But yeah, it's not as good as it should have been or could have been.
I gave it a C-.
Okay.
Yeah, there's definitely some interesting moments, and there's definitely some very cinematic moments. But mm-hmm. as a movie, I think it's just shy of holding together.
Right. I think where if we want to talk just about cinematic versus how well it juggles story and characters and whatever. I do think that there's some moments with music, and there's these kind of these gauzy sort of close-up moments with the characters where I think the director actually does a really good job, and that's kind of where she shines.
For sure, yeah. When
the less they're talking, sometimes the better.
The karaoke sequence is really, I thought that was really good.
Yeah, you kind of get swept up in that. And there's something to be said for me, anyway. There's something to be said about the use of music in film, mm-hmm. and how you can kind of, that's when like, not to sound whatever it is I'm going to sound like, but that's when you kind of like, your feet sort of lifts off the ground of movie and you start to float in the realm of cinema.
For the most part, the music in this movie works pretty well. I think there's a funny, sort of transition a little bit. There's a funny connection between this and Netflix homework.
Yes, there is.
Feature in a very prominent scene the song Crimson and Clover by Tommy James and the Shondells.
Yeah, that song is having a moment right now, that's for sure.
It's a fucking good song.
I mean, it's a great song, and especially if you want to, you know, make your movie all moody.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, that's it. That's that. The Sun Is Also a Star.
It's fine. If you want to snuggle up and not think too much about something, it's fine.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, let's go ahead then and get into the Netflix homework. Which is called what?
Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile.
Right. And this was just released on Netflix a couple weeks ago. This is a film by Joe Berlinger, and it stars Zac Efron as the serial killer Ted Bundy, who traveled the country going to different sororities and meeting young girls where he would torture and kill them. And I didn't know this going in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I didn't know this going into the movie, but the movie is kind of has a sort of an interesting perspective to all of this, because instead of going sort of the usual route of kind of going more the thriller or horror route with a character like this, we're kind of seeing the movie through the eyes of Lily Collins' character, Liz Kendall, who was one of Ted Bundy's main lovers. And biggest supporter, I suppose. And he kept in contact with her throughout all the various trials he was in until he was eventually convicted. But since we're seeing it from her perspective, and her perspective is that she wants to believe that he's innocent, we see very few or almost none of the murders on screen. And I don't think we ever see Zac Efron actually performing a murder on screen. It's always kind of aftermath if we see it at all. And so I think the movie almost has this goal to create realistic, plausible deniability in the audience, even though we already know the ins and outs of this case. It's a highly publicized, and Ted Bundy's had kind of a big year this year with all the different series and documentaries and stuff that have come out, and now this movie. But I thought it was an interesting take on this, is to kind of look at, like, the serial killer as, you know, this was a person in somebody's life that knew him a different way.
Yeah. I mean, it's a take. I was not into that take, really. I got what they were going for. But unfortunately, I feel like Ted Bundy is a character that has in history that has been, in my opinion, a little overly romanticized. And I don't know that this movie does enough to not sort of perpetuate that myth of, and I think that maybe seeing it all from Lily Collins' perspective, kind of made me pretty uncomfortable with this movie, actually. I think Lily Collins does a great job acting. She was great in this. She's great in Tolkien. She's one to watch for fucking sure. I think Zac Efron is fine. He never wows me. Because I feel like the movie doesn't do enough to make you feel like he did it. Like, this movie, it goes so far to do the plausible deniability that it ignores certain aspects of his personality, which were well documented. Yes, he was charming and attractive, but he also had a bit of a temper and a bit of an edge, and could, especially when the court pressures were coming down on him, was known to snap a lot. And even people who thought he might have been innocent sort of could see this uglier side of him. And so, like, I don't think Zac Efron does much as an actor to sort of
ride that line.
Yeah, I think he plays it as Zac Efron with a secret. Like, you know, and sure, they make him look like Ted Bundy, maybe a little more attractive than Ted Bundy was. But I feel like his performance is just a little bit short of what I needed. And maybe that's where my issues come from. Because conceptually, I do think it's interesting. I just think that this movie doesn't do enough to actually show you how much of a monster he was. There is, like, a little bit at the end where Lily Collins sort of has her revelation.
Final confrontation.
Yeah, and I think that, I don't know. It just sort of settled with me a little funky.
Okay. I hold on to your seat. I got, like, a stack of hot takes here.
Okay.
Okay. This movie's getting mixed reviews, which I didn't know after watching it. I thought, that I didn't know exactly what the feeling was out there of this movie. Somehow I came across the Rotten Tomatoes score and it's in the low 50s. And I was actually surprised by that because I thought this was pretty dang good. And I was really kind of swept away in this narrative, and I thought that it was really well paced. I thought that the movie...
See, the pacing was something I had huge issues with, but I'm sorry. Sorry.
I thought that the movie does a really good job at kind of playing this kind of head trick on you, and I was kind of waiting for it, too, like towards like the first, second, or third act, like somewhere in there, that we would see, you know, him sneaking out, putting, like, you know, a smock over his face and knocking someone over the head and, you know, kind of reveling in the violence. I actually kind of liked this way of telling the story more, because there's a couple things in the movie that they bring up. One is that this was one of the first televised cases, which, you know, when you go all the way up to like the OJ trial or even like with the Mueller stuff or whatever, now court TV and this type of stuff has become part of sort of the 24-hour news entertainment cycle. And I think there's kind of like a genesis story of sort of that's going on in this as well, especially towards the last half of the movie. The other hot take, other than the fact that I liked it, apparently a lot of people didn't, is I think there's this sort of, and it's a very of this time, of this moment sort of thing that's going on right now. There's this knee-jerk reactionary response from people who think that all depictions of quote-unquote bad people have to punish the character. And I don't agree with that. I think you can acknowledge that the character is bad, but I think that it is just as artistically responsible or as artistically valid to explore a character's humanity in other ways.
No, I actually do agree with you there. In particular, Ted Bundy is becoming a frustrating figure for me because all you ever hear about is how smart and charming he was, when the truth is, as a person, he wasn't that smart and charming. He got a lot. I mean, he was sure charming enough, but he wasn't that smart. A lot of what he got away with was, it was due to being an educated white man. He got way more privileges than most prisoners were. And I am seeing sort of a trend of sort of romanticizing him as a figure, and that makes me uncomfortable. So yes, I do agree with you that bad characters can be portrayed in all manner you don't have to show him as entirely a monster the whole time or whatever. Like, I agree with that statement.
Well, what I mean by that specifically is even just the way that you frame that as, you know, turning it into a sort of a racial bias that existed at the time. And obviously, if we're talking about the prison system and you're talking about criminal justice, there is always a racial bias that exists there. But I don't think that it's necessarily the responsibility of someone who wants to cover this story to consider that.
I agree with you.
I think that sort of this overall broad, because I've been hearing this because there was the show, and maybe we're just a little Bundied out right now, and that's okay. I have not partaken in most of the Bundy content that came out this year, so this movie was kind of it for me. So maybe that's changed my perspective a little bit, but I think we're living in this time right now where people are really upset at bad people who get away with things, because there's a lot of bad people who are getting away with things right now. And I think that maybe that, you know, and I think this is interesting as far as just the conversation goes, but I think that is creating a sort of reflexive bias in people who consume these type of stories.
I think that is fair, though. I think it's I don't know. I just honestly, this movie left me feeling a little gross. I felt like the execution didn't. To me, it felt like the execution didn't achieve what I wanted it to. Like, I got what they were going for with seeing it through Lily Collins' eyes.
Right.
I actually hated the pacing of this movie. I thought it was bad. I thought it, like, the way...
Bad how?
It jumps a lot of time, and a lot of stuff happens in that time. even if we're seeing it from Lily Collins' perspective, it just feels like chunks of this are missing. Like it feels like it's just from, I don't know. He's like, you know, he gets picked up for a DUI, and then the next thing we know, he's escaping for the first time, and it just feels like there's not a lot of connective tissue there.
I think the goal of the storytelling, the way that it's plotted out, is to cover his time in jail more than anything else, and sort of his interactions with the criminal justice system.
I get that, but it seems like even that is sort of skipped over so much. Because we don't really see him in jail that much. Like, you know, we see him. I mean, every time we do see him is pretty much when he's talking to Lily Collins, and I feel like for a movie called Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil and Vile, like, we're not seeing that literally until the very end.
I agree. I think that is intentional, though. I think, and I think they picked that title the way they picked it, almost ironically.
Yeah,
because I get your discomfort with it, and I understand, like, you know, if there was a person who saw this who wasn't super familiar with the Bundy case, they might walk away with enough plausible deniability to be like, oh, maybe he didn't do it. I don't know.
Yeah, and I personally don't like that at all. And I think that they're between, and like I said, maybe it is because I have been consuming more information about him recently. But that should be relevant to to a cultural figure. Like, you know, like that is a big part of his story. And I think it's interesting the way we see Lily Collins getting emotionally tortured, but we don't see or hear any of that from any of his other victims. And she's the one who lived. I don't know. There's something weird about that to me. When he's killed at least 30 women, it feels like that's kind of downplayed in this.
No, it's purposely downplayed. That's what I'm saying. It's like it's omitted.
Yeah, and that's frustrating to me.
I get that, but that comes back to my initial analysis of, you know, we're in this time right now where people want to see bad people punished. And that's not always what I need from a movie.
It's not that I need to see him punished. I feel like we're not getting...
Or shamed.
Not even that. I feel like we're not getting really... his story. I feel like we're getting a very small sliver of it that's being sold as like the story. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I think for me, the difference is I see it as a feature, not a bug. I like the roundabout way that they told the story because for me anyways, this is a pretty well-known serial killer. One of the most well-known serial killers. And we've seen so many of the other way of doing this, the kind of Silence of the Lambs treatment. You know, there was a shitty Ted Bundy movie that came out like direct to DVD. And that's, you know, if the people want to see that, that movie exists. If you just want to see him like choking ladies out, there's a whole other movie of that.
I don't want to see that necessarily either. I just don't want, you know, because I feel like it's a little irresponsible. I don't know. I didn't particularly care for this movie. I felt like it felt glossy and romanticized in ways that made me uncomfortable. And it's not that I need to see a bad person get punished. I don't need to see Ted Bundy's character get assassinated because he is a fucking monster. Right. To me, to portray him as anything less than that does feel a little irresponsible. I think there is a moment when it works, and that's at the very end. But for me, that was too little too late.
Okay. Yeah, I'm willing to admit that the movie takes a huge risk with the way it's structured. And for me, that pays off. And I guess for a lot of other people, it doesn't.
Yeah, I didn't care for it. I don't know. Wasn't for me.
All right. Well, this is a new enough movie. I think it deserves a grade. I'm going to give it a B+. What are you giving it?
I would. I'd actually give this a C-. Same
wow.
thing.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. This is the podcast that politely disagrees to agree right now. This doesn't happen very often. We're this far apart on a movie. But what do you have? What are we watching next week for the Netflix homework?
Your Netflix assignment is The Little Hours, 2017 comedy movie about nuns starring Alison Brie, Dave Franco, Aubrey Plaza. I've heard good things, so.
All right.
I wanted to give it a shot. The Little Hours.
The Little Hours. All right. And if anybody has anything to, or they want to weigh in on anything that we discussed here, underrated movies, the shockingly evil and extremely close and whatever it's called, The Sun is Also a Star, if you happen to catch that. I mean, I know it's the biggest movie of 2019, so I'm sure everybody saw it.
I wanted to watch John Wick 3, for the record.
You still can. I can't stop you from seeing anything, Keith.
I see one movie a week. That's usually it. I don't have time to see other movies.
I know. I have that plan where you can watch 3 movies a week, and I never do, and I feel like I'm wasting money.
I literally, like, Tuesdays are, like, the only night I can even watch movies right now, so.
But if anybody wants to weigh in on any of that, you can email us at MacGuffinPod@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at MacGuffinPod, and follow us on Facebook at Facebook.com/MacGuffinPod to see other listener surveys or movie news that we post or episodes when they go up. You can stream us and listen to us at iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Player.fm, and Pocket Cast. And you can read my writing that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal at idahostatejournal.com under the Arts and Entertainment tab. And you can also read some of the content I provided for the MacGuffin, their homepage at macguff.in/author/Cassidy. When you're there, you'll see these episodes, and you will also see different articles from the other writers and contributors to the website. You can also follow me individually on Twitter at VC Cassidy.
You can check me out on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook at Keith Foster Kid. Check out my website, www.keithfosterkid.com, for upcoming live show dates.
Yes. And be sure to check out our friends out there who are doing podcasts of their own, including Patrick and Dennis over at Almost Educational, Bill and Brian over at the Great Albums Podcast, which I just listened to one of their last like mailbag episodes, and they have announced that they are hanging up the towel on the Great Albums Podcast, another one biting the dust.
Have you outlasted most of your podcast friends at this
point? Yeah, I think, well, you know, kind of. I mean, we're not Jabber and the Drone anymore, but a lot of my graduating class have either moved on or are doing other things now. But stay subscribed to the Great Albums, because they said they're going to be putting up kind of special episodes every once in a while, year-end lists, things like that. And I think they have other projects that they're trying to figure out down the line. And I put it out there in the ether, in the universe, that if Patrick from Almost Educational and Bill from the Great Albums ever wanted to collaborate on a comic book podcast, there might be a lot of people who'd be interested in that. So just pinning that on my wish board. And check out Mike Fallick over at Hack Thought and Buddy and Alice over at Those Happy Places and Rogue Fun, a Star Wars podcast.
And since I mentioned him earlier, I'll just throw out one more plug for my friend Mike Brown. He's an improviser out of New York. He used to do this YouTube channel called Gotta Love Them Movies, where he would do movie reviews. He's taken to doing more of a Facebook Live movie discussion. But if you hit him up and send him your movie questions, or if you just want to talk to him about movies, he'll talk about it over his Facebook live streams. He does them every Wednesday at noon Eastern time. And he's a fun dude. So check him out if you get a chance.
Cool. And that is the end of the show.
The court finds that both of these killings were indeed heinous, atrocious, and cruel, and that they were extremely wicked, shockingly evil, vile, and the product of a design to inflict a high degree of pain and utter indifference to human life. This court, independent of, but in agreement with the advisory sentence rendered by the jury, does hereby impose the death penalty upon the defendant, Theodore Robert Bundy.